Good morning, everybody. Thank you guys so much for being here. I recognize some faces that have been here for each of these classes, and today is the third, and unfortunately the last one for now, but we've saved a good one, saved the best for last. So, but for those of y'all that weren't here for the first couple of classes, 2 weeks ago, Sarah gave us a great sort of overview of the history of mission in the church. And then last week we had group one share about our experience in Greece this past summer with the refugees and about the refugee camps and the hospitality and some other stories. And today we're going to talk a bit about the grassroots efforts that are happening on the ground. And really, that's where all of the effort really is coming from, is small groups like ours, and people really just sort of jumping in and starting organizations, starting programs, starting projects to be helpful in the refugee crisis, because it's just so massive, there's no way that any one, two, or three organizations can really address everything. So today we're going to, we have three folks from group two that are going to share about Hope Cafe, which is a wonderful program that Catherine's going to tell us about, and the Eleninko Warehouse, which you'll hear about from Hunter, and then Megan is going to talk to us about a really special dinner that both groups got to have with a family in Athens. So Catherine, if you want to come on up. If I can get these going. Of course, it worked just fine about 20 minutes ago. Why don't you go ahead and start.
So,
figure this out.
Perfect. So I'm Catherine Vernon. Hi. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about Hope Cafe. Hope Cafe is essentially an unassuming storefront in a lower working class neighborhood in Athens. It's about 12 feet wide by 24 feet deep. Where are we? What? It has a mind of its own. So on one side you walk in, there are tables. The other side is a bar. It clearly used to be some sort of restaurant or cafe, and it's in the back is a kitchen. And so upon arrival, when you get to Hope Cafe as a volunteer for the day, refugee volunteers get you tea, they get you something to eat. And then the current leader of Hope Cafe, who is Kirsten when we were there, will give you a rundown of the services that Hope Cafe offers. There are now three main services that Hope Cafe provides to refugees in the neighborhood. One, twice a day, a hot meal is served to anyone who walks through the doors. You can be a refugee, Greek, lost tourist, it doesn't matter, they'll feed you. Two, upstairs there is a clothing store where registered families get one clothing appointment every 3 months. And on Tuesdays and Fridays, registered families can come get diapers, wipes, formula, and baby detergent. So those are the main kind of themes of Hope Cafe. Hope Cafe is now the only organization in the neighborhood that supplies families with babies, diapers, wipes, and things like that. Interestingly enough, the first group spoke about Hope Cafe and talked about packing packs of food, dried goods, flour, sugar, cooking oil, things like that. They don't do that anymore. In the week between our two trips, they discovered that other organizations in the neighborhood were providing the same service. And so they kind of dropped that off and decided that they would focus on providing for babies in the refugee community locally, because nobody else, that was a big need, and nobody else was doing it. So the three main parts are food, clothing, and caring for babies, which are three basic but huge missions. We all tried our best to absorb the information that Kirsten was giving us, but honestly, it's a bustling place, and people are coming in and out constantly, and five or six languages are being spoken, and you're just trying to tread water at first. So we did our best to help where we could. Megan went upstairs to help families with clothing appointments. Hunter and Mark washed thousands of dishes. And then Sarah and I ended up coloring with the kids at Hope Cafe. There's a lot of waiting in a situation like this, and the kids and their parents would come in. The parents would go to a clothing appointment. They would stand in line waiting for diapers. They would do a number of things. And the kids were just kind of left to their own devices. In fact, our group got together and made like coloring book pages for kids to color while they waited. And sometime later, I heard Hunter exclaim to one of the volunteers, "Oh, well, Catherine works for attorneys." And I thought, no, don't get me into this. I am not an attorney and I am not legal help. But what they needed was someone to help them write a code of conduct that they had been on the ground for like 18 months working to get refugees everything that they needed. And they had yet to have a chance to say, here are the rules for volunteering here. Here are the rules for working here. So I found myself at a laptop helping two women in charge write a code of conduct for all the volunteers and refugee volunteers at Hope Cafe. We set the ground rules on volunteer attendance, on hours, on locking up, on opening up, and any sort of conflict resolution and more. And that took quite some time to sort through the issues that they had been having. The second half of my day was spent giving out packs of diapers, wipes, formula, and baby detergent to families with infants and toddlers. So families would come in, find a refugee volunteer to translate, present their registration card, and receive the appropriate size diapers, wipes, and formula. But as the afternoon wore on, we ran out of wipes, and then we ran out of diapers, size 3, 4, and 5. And then we ran out of formula too. And there is nothing worse than looking a mother in the face and shaking your head no. No, we don't have what your baby needs. No, we don't have the only food your baby can have. No, I don't know when the next shipment's coming. We were told it would come today, but we don't know where it is. Megan counted, and we had to turn away over 55 families because we ran out of supplies for them. We were handing out baby supplies. We were working with two students from France who had been at Hope Cafe for some time. The girl whose name has left me kept saying to the angry, disappointed, scared parents, "I cannot give you what I don't have." The phrase has stuck with me. It is as true of diapers and wipes as it is of forgiveness and grace and hope. I cannot give you what I don't have. May we all, going forward, have enough.
Thank you. That was great, and I'm so glad you did point out sort of how helpless feeling it is to run out of supplies and things, and also, again, just how important like the grassroots effort is. Is that it's a day by day, is there enough money to buy the supplies that are needed for that day? And it's day by day situation. So thank you so much for explaining that. Next, Hunter, if you want to come on up. I don't want to steal your thunder, but I will say that the Hunter's going to talk to us about what's called the Eleniko Warehouse, which is in Athens, and I'm sure you'll explain sort of the history of those buildings and all that good stuff. And a couple of my favorite pictures of both trips is one of Hunter that I'm going to show you in just a minute. Here you go, Hunter.
I don't get it.
You know what? I think some people.
You do?
Yeah. Some. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. More.
Yeah. So, the warehouse is a very misleading name for this place. It was actually the site of the 2004 Olympic Games. It was the main headquarters. So this is where America, China, Russia, England all won gold medals. And the place we focus on was the basketball arena. So this is where Coach K, Kobe Bryant, and other names from 2004 won the gold medal. It is a place of prestige that we hold high even as Americans. We love our basketball, right, North Carolina? Now, every single inch, except for the walkways, is covered with boxes from donations from all over the world, from America, from England, even Latin America, parts of Europe, parts of Asia. All over, we saw different clothes being donated. It was a very surreal experience. When we were driving up there, it's in the middle of Athens. It's the old airport. You could see the ocean right there. You can see downtown Athens, not too far off in the distance. If I walked a mile anywhere, I would be in downtown Athens. But imagine going into a wasteland, an area that is devoid, deserted, almost like a science fiction nuclear holocaust went off or something. There's maybe someone at the gate, maybe there's not. And we pulled up in our tiny little van up to the basketball arena, straight up to the front door, never mind the parking spots. And it was beautiful. It was lined with marble. It was expertly crafted. But here it's been using, as we call it, a warehouse. When you get in there, you can see that there's some lights on. There's people hustle and bustling. There's a concession stand that's been turned into a makeshift kitchen right at the entrance. But there's one thing, and as a Southerner, I love that wasn't there: air conditioning. I spent middle school and high school in Texas, and I played Texas football. I did two-a-days in the hot Texas heat when it was very dry, sometimes in 105, 106 degree weather. So I got used to heat. Going into this warehouse and working was probably the hottest I've ever been in my life. Coming in here, you just see row upon row upon row of boxes. And I did a little exploring at first just to get my bearings. I felt like I was Bilbo Baggins of the Hobbit going deep into the misty mountains, exploring straight into this area. And it just went on and on and on and on with all these boxes of donations all over the world. But the one thing is, they were in this warehouse. They were not in the hands of the people that absolutely need them. So we were tasked with going through the boxes and organizing them through gender, through season, and whatnot. And we worked all day. We eventually did have to take a 30-minute break and just lie down on the cool, cool marble. That was about 98 degrees. It felt great. But that was exhausting work. And I have moved boxes plenty of times before, but I had the grace of working in air conditioning. So we worked very hard. We had a system. We joined in with other people that showed up. We had a trio of college students from Edinburgh show up, a high school from Spain show up, about 40 volunteers. There was a few Italians? Yes, Italians there too. And we worked together, we had a system. By the end of the day, it looked like we had gotten nothing done. There was no dent whatsoever. And the delivery system from this warehouse to, say, maybe Hope Cafe or other distribution points was the van we rode in on. One van to help deliver probably, well, 1 million pounds of clothes. People were working as hard as they could, but there just wasn't enough people. So what I'm always going to remember about this warehouse is, yeah, I'm happy to help here. Sure, I can go through my closet and donate clothes, but the real help is getting your feet on the ground and physically doing that work. That's how you help people.
Thank you, Hunter. Yeah, that's so true, and Hunter talks about the van that we were driving in, and the organization that we partnered with, that St. Paul's partnered with, is called Allied Aid. Some of y'all have heard us talk about it before, but it's a group of five people that when they first went to Greece to volunteer with a different organization, they went to this warehouse and did the same work that our groups did, and there was no van. There was no transportation. And this was really at the height of the influx of thousands and thousands of refugees coming off of ferries daily. And so they got together and started this organization called Allied Aid and raised $8,000 to buy a van. And that was about a year and a half ago. And as Hunter mentioned, that's it. There's a volunteer driver named Fadi, who we all got to know and love. And he's the one that they take orders from refugee camps all over the country. And as they are able to, he drives a load, you know, up north or to various camps across the country. And so it's quite a feat. So thanks, Hunter, for that. And now Megan is going to tell us about a special dinner. If I may, I'm going to give a little bit of a background on Muhammad, just on how we met him. When Group One was there, on our first day, we went grocery shopping for Hope Cafe. As Catherine mentioned, when Group One was there, they were doing food. By the time Group Two was there, they were doing something else. So Nikos, who's here, our friend from Greece, and volunteers for Allied Aid, he was helping us that day, and then two folks from Hope Cafe went to do the grocery shopping. One of those two volunteers from Hope Cafe was Muhammad, and he was the one that was with us when we sort of got set up, we think, and somebody slashed our tire. We got a flat tire. The four of us are tending to the tire in this underground parking lot, and while that happens, in the span of maybe 30 seconds, both of our backpacks were stolen. And so Muhammad had a chance to see me completely melt down, and was so kind. And you know, and I reflected later on about the irony of me being so upset about losing a backpack with some cash and credit card and some personal things in it, when here was this guy who he and his family had lost their home, had lost family members. They had been walking and staying in refugee camps for the last 18 months. And it just struck me that, wow. And here he was being compassionate towards me. But anyway, so that's sort of the how we got to know Muhammad. And Megan's just going to tell us about a really special dinner that we got to have.
Yeah, thank you, Sally. So I'm Megan from Team 2, and we do refer to this dinner as the dinner at Muhammad's house because, as Sally was saying, he was our connection to this family. Team 2 first met him at the Hope Cafe, and I remember seeing him there, but at the time I didn't know who he was or if he was there to receive food or to volunteer or both, and I actually didn't know if he spoke any English or not either. So in the chaos that is the Hope Cafe, we just kind of smiled at each other and continued working. It wasn't until the end of the day that I realized, when Sally pointed him out to us, that he was the one who'd been so gracious to Team 1, and he absolutely continued that generosity with Team 2 when they invited us to dinner in their home as well. They lived in a sort of apartment, or maybe it was a hotel that had been converted into apartments that had seen its glory days long ago. I'm not sure how his family was in an apartment rather than a camp, but I suspect it was because they were in one of the first waves of refugees who came over before the United Nations Refugee Agency built the camps. When we first walked through the door, it was immediately apparent that we came from different cultures, and both of us were eager to cater to the other culture. So when we first walked in, we forgot to take our shoes off. And we ran back to the door as soon as we realized it. And we're like, oh, I'm so sorry, I'll take my shoes off. And they were like, no, it's fine, it's totally fine. Keep your shoes on, it's fine. So both of us were really eager to cater to the other culture. And we also knew that handshakes between men and women are uncommon in their culture. So we were prepared to place our hands over our hearts and bow, but they were eager to stick out their hands and shake our hands. No, it's fine, we'll shake your hands. So even just these initial gestures warmed my heart because we were both so eager to please the other people from the other culture. Now the food. Just look at the food. I have no idea how they were able to obtain all of these ingredients for such a magnificent feast to feed us all. I particularly remember the grape leaves that were rolled around rice and lamb and then cooked. Muhammad's mother, speaking through her brother and sister-in-law as translators, she relayed to us that these were a particular type of Syrian grape leaf. She wanted us to know that all the things we were eating were Syrian, traditional Syrian food, even down to the grape leaves. Each dish, as it was traditional Syrian food, was something that I had never had before, at least in those combinations, but some of it was familiar. I mean, we had cucumbers and tomatoes, eggplant, zucchini, but the eggplant and zucchini were stuffed, as were those empanada pocket style things with chicken, lamb, rice, and unfamiliar spices. It was all absolutely delicious, and it must have taken her all day to make all of that food. I mean, she had to hand roll and hand cook each individual grape leaf and each little empanada thing that I wish I had a better name for. And she had to take the core out of each zucchini and the core out of each eggplant and stuff them with the lamb and the rice. I mean, this is a labor-intensive meal. It must have taken her all day long. And there were so many different dishes. I mean, the table was full of food, as you can see. During the dinner, she reminded me of my grandmother hovering around the table and darting back and forth from the kitchen to the table to make sure that everybody had exactly what they needed. I couldn't believe the lengths she went to make such an elaborate meal for people she had never even met before and who did not share her language or her beliefs. This was an Arabic-speaking Muslim family, and they opened their doors to English-speaking Christian Americans and went to great lengths to provide for us. Now the dinner conversation. It was probably the most fascinating I've ever had. Her brother Bashir and sister-in-law Lilaf were visiting from Sweden, which is where they had been relocated after escaping from Syria. They shared their joy with us at being reunited. They hadn't seen each other in 4 years. In fact, Muhammad's mother hadn't seen her husband in 4 years either. They were separated when they first got to Greece because he was injured, and injured people were escorted one direction, and non-injured people were escorted the other direction. So she hadn't seen her husband, and Muhammad hadn't seen his father in 4 years. Now, they've had word that he's in Germany and hope, as all refugees do, to be reunited sometime in the future. Bashir and Lilaf revealed to us that they had never met any Americans before they met us. And we were very curious about their country, just as they were very curious about our country, which is a country that they know they are not allowed to see. We exchanged many stories and observations. Both Bashir and Lilaf were well-educated, with college degrees in economics. They told us what Syria was like before the war. In their words, as I recall them, "We knew we weren't free, but we had order, stability, routine, access to free education, homes, families, communities. Every now and then someone would disappear, and everyone was required to vote, and there was only one name on the ballot. So we knew we weren't free, but we had many good things. When the war started, the choice was either leave or die. So we left. Now we're scattered all over. Before, our whole family lived in the same area of Aleppo, not even just in the same city, in the same area of Aleppo. And now we have family in Germany, Sweden, Greece, many other countries, and even one uncle still in Syria who refused to leave. We haven't seen anyone else from our family in 4 years. Freedom cost us our country." That quote from Bashir, "Freedom cost us our country," is burned into my memory. I felt as though their implication was that it wasn't worth it, which is a completely foreign concept to me as an American. Any American, generations removed from revolution, would say, well, freedom is definitely always worth it, but is freedom worth the fight if it turns your cities to ash and rubble, kills hundreds of thousands in the streets, gives your children PTSD and burn scars, forces the survivors into a life of hardship and exile, and then doesn't even work in the end? Who am I to say? These are questions that were raised during our dinner table conversation. When we were finished with our meal, we ended the evening with those tiny cups of the richest coffee I've ever had in my entire life, flavored with unfamiliar but delicious spices. They scrambled to provide sugar for the coffee and finally produced it in an old plastic yogurt cup. Not wanting to be rude, but also not wanting to use up their supply of sugar, we took very tiny spoonfuls and continued exchanging stories of America and Syria. At one point, the conversation turned toward the natural wonders America has to offer, and we learned that Bashir loves hiking, just like we do. They also told us that while they were very grateful to be in Sweden, it was a lot colder there than what they were used to. A lot more snow. We found out that Sweden gives refugees who are expectant mothers, as Lilaf was, a care package full of diapers, wet wipes, baby clothes, all of the items that we wished we had unlimited supplies of to give to all of the refugees that we found in Greece. It occurred to me that countries who choose how many and which refugees they take in are much better able to take care of those refugees that they have. Greece, where refugees literally wash up on their shores by the thousands, doesn't have a choice but to take in whoever they get, even though they don't have the resources to be able to handle such a massive crisis. As we left, we said shukran with our hands over our hearts, which is thank you in Arabic, and Muhammad's mother's eyes glowed in appreciation at us trying to speak her language and use her customs, but once again they made a point to shake our hands, and Muhammad's mother, every time we said shukran, she said back very softly, welcome, welcome. We put our shoes back on and made our way back through Athens by foot, bus, metro, and van, full of thankfulness and forever changed by the kindness and openness of the Syrian family that night. Later, we wrote a thank you note to the family and sent it with a tin of Old Salem Moravian cookies, wishing we could do more. Bashir translated the note for his family before going back to Sweden, and Muhammad sent the sweetest voice message back, saying it was their pleasure and sounding overwhelmed by our thankfulness. We do nothing for you, is a quote that sticks out in my mind from his message. We do nothing for you. But the truth is, they did so much more than they could ever realize. They were so humble and gracious, and they never expected anything in return. More than just the food, they gave us firsthand accounts and insight that you can't get anywhere else. It's easy to be afraid of refugees from afar. It's easy to refuse them aid if you don't have to do it to their faces. But when you actually speak to them face to face, it changes everything. That's the difference that face-to-face interactions make, and that's why trips like this are so important. Thank you.
Thanks, Megan. That was great. Thank you, guys, all three of y'all. I think you gave such a good overview of what the trips were like. What questions do y'all have for these three? How many refugees are there? Right now, there are about between 60 and 65,000 that are stranded in Greece. What was that? Did somebody else say something? Yeah, just in Greece, so. Not enough. You know, at each place, it's a little bit different. Like you heard, you know, Hunter talking about at the warehouse, I know daily there are individuals and small groups from all over the world. The same with Hope Cafe. You have college students that were there in the summer. Summertime is a lot easier to, yeah. You want to go back? I know. Yeah, the summertime, of course, it's easier to get people to go for a week or two. I think what's really needed more so than that are people that are able to go for long term, you know, for 6 months or 9 months, because there is so much turnover with volunteers that at Hope Cafe, Carrie, the woman that started it, it was maybe about 8 months ago that she started it, and she was working in England in her hometown and went down to volunteer and was so affected the way that a lot of us were and decided to go back and open this Hope Cafe. But it's just her. And then volunteers that kind of come in and out. So it's, but it's a really, it's amazing though, just the international effort of small groups. Is St. Paul's giving a large financial, giving a significant amount of financial support? I would not call it significant, no. We, before we traveled over there, we donated, I think it was $500 to help ship crates of baby food over. And then for each of our trips, we funded the projects that we worked on. Group One did a pergola at the refugee camp, so you know St. Paul's paid for those supplies, and so we supported our own trips that way. And that, of course, helps Allied Aid get more work done. But yeah, yes.
Is it possible for the refugees to volunteer and help sort in the basketball arena?
Yes, good question. And they do. And they love to, because they have nothing going on all day, every day. And so Muhammad volunteers at Hope Cafe every day, who we had dinner with. Ghassan, I know one of y'all got to know Ghassan, a refugee that worked in the El Anico warehouse and took, I think he traveled an hour and a half each way to the warehouse every day to volunteer. So that's definitely happening. The challenge is there's no one central organization that can say, okay, all 1,000 refugees from Scaramanga, let's all go to the warehouse. There's no central group that's in charge. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
I think in a previous week you mentioned there was an Anglican church that you went to and maybe fellowshiped with some folks. I wanted to follow up on that. Was there ever a chance that you met any Christian refugees that you had a chance to fellowship with?
Yeah, we. I know earlier in another trip, I met a wonderful woman from Morocco who was a refugee, and her family really had disowned her because she had become Christian. And it sounded like somebody over here was saying, me, me, me. So, yeah.
So when we were at Camp Enofita, which I know Team One went to as well, when we went there, we went to the sewing room where the refugees were making bags, like handbags and books, out of their old tents. And there was one guy who came up to us, and he said, you are Christian? We said, yes, we are Christian. He said, oh, it is so good to see a Christian. He was also Christian and had left, I believe it was Iran, for that reason.
He did not leave Iran. He was kicked out of Iran for being Christian.
Thanks. And also another group to mention that has a lot of presence in Athens are the Yazidis, who are from northern Iraq. And they are also Christian and fled due to religious persecution. Mount Sinjar, I'm sure a lot of y'all recall hearing about that. And there's, so to answer your question, you know, a lot of the Yazidis, there are several hundred Yazidis that lived in Scaramanga, the camp where we were, and that we had a lot of interaction with as well. Yes.
Couple logistical questions. So there's 65,000. What was the peak? How long is it? How quickly is it going down? What's going to happen to the refugees who can't go anywhere? What do they do?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I wish I had a short answer for it. I can tell you that at its peak in November of 15, there were hundreds of thousands of refugees that were crossing through Greece daily. I think the overall number now is up to about 2 million that have passed through or stuck there. But what happened in March of 16 was that the rest of the borders around Greece closed. You know, Greece had been just a transit country for the refugees that they just traveled through. But when the Balkan route was closed and those borders closed, that's sort of what trapped the 60 or 65,000 that are in Greece now. Yeah. 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 And there's, yes, the numbers are going down, but not like you would hope. There's something called the Dublin regulations, which, and there's a deal between the EU and Turkey about, you know, when one refugee leaves an island and goes back to Turkey, then they'll send a refugee that's in Turkey to the EU, and that has not gone well. Germany had reduced it. Mohammed's family was approved for family reunification in Germany, which is quite a process. And then soon after they got approved, Germany and Greece sort of negotiated this deal sort of on the sly that they would only take 70 refugees per month. And that went on for several months, and just about 2 weeks ago, that was ruled to be illegal. So now hopefully that number can start going back up again. But it's a global problem. It's a global problem. Yes, Rachel.
I wanted to kind of piggyback off of this, you know, two things, piggybacking off of the, what is St. Paul doing? One, I think the common theme that we heard from everybody is obviously the best thing to do is to go there and do it, but that's not possible for most of this congregation. So, one, do you know, or are there plans for more that St. Paul's parishioners and folks can contribute to monetarily, or donations that we can, you know, they need diapers, are we going to do something where we can send that, A? B, I know that in itself is logistical trouble and hard to do, but Allied Aid, or are there other organizations that you could recommend that as we tell people about this, that we can share with them, donate to Allied Aid, donate to the Red Cross, whatever, to for those of us who can't go?
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for bringing that up. Allied Aid is a wonderful organization that I would absolutely get the most bang for your buck donating to them. To answer your question about St. Paul's, we do have a refugee relief fund that is just starting to grow. We've had a circle or two that has contacted me that has money that they'd like to contribute. The best thing that we can do is to contribute financially so that things can be purchased in country, in Greece. That helps their economy. And it's just a lot more meaningful if we purchase supplies over there. So if anybody is interested in donating, you can just send a check to St. Paul's and in the memo line put Refugee Relief Fund, and it will get into that pot of money that we'll be using to purchase other supplies. Great. Well, I hear the bells ringing, so I guess time's up. But thank you guys so much for sharing. Oh, sorry, Nikos. Elizabeth did that to you. This is our friend Nikos. You want to stand up? okay, you're good. You can sit down. You can thank Elizabeth for that. Nikos is a volunteer with Allied Aid in Greece, and really the team can tell y'all how helpful he is to all of the groups, but we're so glad to have him here in the States to visit for a couple of weeks. So thank you for being here. And thanks everybody for coming. Yeah.